It would be impressive if it wasn't so frightening.
Melanie Evans is the Wall Street Journal's hospital reporter. She covers a startling trend in medicine, bacteria rapidly evolving to outsmart our toughest antibiotics.
I can describe what happened at a hospital in Nevada to explain what's at stake when antibiotics stop working.
An elderly woman went to the hospital after breaking a bone.
And she arrived at the hospital and she had an infection in her hip and her thigh. The hospital's laboratory ran every test that it could, and it could not find an antibiotic that could stop her infection.
I was a little bit shocked when I see all R's. You know, R means resistant.
That's epidemiologist Dr. Lei Chen. The patient had a superbug, a bacteria that's adapted to resist treatment. They raced her sample to a federal lab where they tested it against 26 different antibiotics.
And not one of those antibiotics worked.
Resistance is going to happen regardless of what we do.
And that's Dr. Alexander Callan at the CDC.
But what we are trying to do is to slow the spread with the hope and the expectation that as we learn more, be able to develop better and better ways to prevent transmission and hold resistance at bay.
Antibiotics save countless lives, but there's a catch. The more we use, the less effective they become until one day they won't work at all. And the man who discovered the world's first antibiotic, penicillin, knew this. Alexander Fleming warned us about a post-antibiotic world all the way back in 1945, after he won the Nobel Prize. Scientists are racing against the clock to stay one step ahead. The goal is to use advances in technology to beat evolution at its own game.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
This episode is an underdog story, and the underdogs are us. Around the world, roughly 700,000 people die each year from drug-resistant infections, and those deaths could soar to 10 million by 2050, unless we find a way soon to stay ahead of bacteria. It sounds simple enough, but some of these strains have been around since the Paleozoic era. We begin in an emergency room in Durham, North Carolina.
This is Ephraim Salek.
He's an ER doctor at the VA hospital.
So now as the weather's starting to get a little colder, we start to see a lot more people coming in with the crud, the runny nose, the sore throat, the cough, and that really peaks to a large degree December, January.
So doctors give antibiotics to sick patients, but those only work against bacterial infections, not viruses and allergies.
Sometimes it's fairly straightforward. We can figure it out pretty easily and then target our treatment to what it is that's going on. But there are other times where you just kind of shrug your shoulders and say, you know what, I really don't know.
Because doctors don't have a quick way to determine a patient's type of infection, they're left with no choice but to guess.
So it's really challenging. And right now, we just sort of make the best use of the tools we have, and we get it wrong the majority of the time. You know, if you look at the distribution in terms of how many people end up on antibiotics every year, it averages out to be about one in every two adults, and just about every child gets an antibiotic. And respiratory illness is the most common reason for that. Viruses are responsible for about 75% of those. And if we were managing those appropriately, you would find that none of those patients end up on antibiotics, and yet about two-thirds of them do. That ends up resulting in millions upon millions of unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions every year.
The overprescribing of antibiotics is turning hospitals into superbug factories. It means we're turning to the most powerful drugs we have at a faster rate, and that puts our last line of defense against bacteria in jeopardy. But it's not just hospitals. I visited a nearby grocery store with reporter Melanie Evans, where we saw foods labeled antibiotic-free right and left.
Let's see. Is raised without antibiotics. That's one label. No antibiotics ever. That's another one. Different labels, all making the same point. No antibiotics.
But why are antibiotics in meat in the first place?
Right at the beginning of the antibiotic era.
Maren McKenna is an investigative journalist. She's also the author of Big Chicken, a new book about antibiotics in agriculture.
When the nascent manufacturers of antibiotics were looking for markets for their new drugs, one of those manufacturers realized it could also make a case for it to be used in animals to put on muscle mass faster. And later on, they also were able to make a case for selling their antibiotic also as a preventive treatment.
Farmers quickly adopted the drugs as a way to save money, though there's always been antibiotic-free farms.
they might have been organic or they might have been pasture-based. They're usually fairly small. The really interesting evolution right now is that very large meat producers are also going antibiotic-free, and this has happened first in the world of poultry.
They're doing this by returning to older practices, things like sunshine, exercise, and better nutrition. And she says consumer pressure is what made the change happen, both in business and in government.
There's been a consumer movement since about 2010 pushing for change in how meat producers use antibiotics. And because of that consumer pressure, both the federal rules changed and the meat companies agreed to change. And so for the meat companies, it's a way to signal that they're going along with what consumers want.
But the labels at the grocery store only tell part of the story.
When the federal rules were changed, that change banned only growth promotion to cause animals to put on weight more quickly.
And farms can use antibiotic-free claims even if they still use them for other reasons.
Nobody wants to ban treating animals if they are in fact sick, but there's still a big mushy middle category that is still fully legal, doesn't really show up on most of those label claims on meat packages, and is still pretty contentious among researchers.
She's referring to using antibiotics as a way to prevent sickness in healthy farm animals. One reason that matters is because these are the same drugs we use in medicine.
If bacteria become resistant in the system of an animal that's been given antibiotics that are used in humans, and those bacteria migrate via meat or via some other pathway to a human and cause a drug-resistant infection, we then can't cure that infection because the drug that we would have used has already been undermined by its use in livestock.
And that's why groups, including the World Health Organization, are urging farms to stop using antibiotics in some situations. Right now, governments deem about a dozen superbugs a serious threat. One of them is Enterococcus.
I'm Michael Gilmore. I'm a professor at Harvard Medical School and a scientist at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary.
Gilmore tracks its evolutionary history.
We can look at the DNA of bacteria now in ways that we never could before. And that's giving us a new understanding of what makes bacteria behave the way they do. How do they get resistant?
Enterococcus quickly becomes resistant to anything we throw at it. So we asked him, are there drugs that still stand a chance?
Yes, ish. So we keep introducing new ones, and shortly thereafter, Enterococcus develops resistance to those. And so it's which day of the week is this? And so is the answer. There are examples of Enterococcus being resistant to everything that we have to throw at it. And so it's always a challenge to stay one step ahead of these microbes.
So how did Enterococcus get to be so tough anyway? For that, we have to go back 500 million years, around the time life transitioned from water to land, the first animals, plants, and the Enterococcus, too. This bacteria survived the mass extinction that wiped out dinosaurs, and scientists think it's due to genes it picked up in the Paleozoic era that may be helping it thrive, despite drugs and disinfectants. Gilmore says if we continue to throw antibiotics at it, resistance will continue at a faster rate than we can keep up with.
Right now, the average lifespan for an antibiotic before resistance becomes a problem is about 5 or 8 years. So you can develop a new one and it'll be good for 5 to 8 years before resistance starts emerging at such a frequency that people would want to have a different antibiotic. If we use that antibiotic 1/10 as often as we did, then rather than resistance occurring in 5 to 8 years, it would occur in 50 to 80 years. And if we could get even 20 years out of an antibiotic instead of 5 years, then our ability to discover new antibiotics would much more easily keep pace.
It's a science problem. It's an economic problem. It's also a mathematical probability.
If we expose one microbe to an antibiotic, the chance of that microbe developing resistance is about 1 in 1 billion. If we expose 1 billion microbes to that antibiotic, the chance of resistance of one of those is 1. So, for example, in our guts, we have about 100 trillion bacteria. That's a lot. If we expose all of those to a drug, the chance that some are going to be resistant is pretty high. But if we put that drug as an eye drop, where there are only 10,000 bacteria, the chance of resistance developing is much, much smaller. So that's another virtue of using narrow-spectrum drugs and targeted delivery.
But there's a good reason why we still use too many broad-spectrum drugs. We don't have tests that quickly let doctors know what's making someone sick.
We use agar plates to diagnose bacterial infections most of the time.
That's Nancy Henshaw in Duke University's Clinical Microbiology Lab, where we saw many, many agar plates. It's the Petri dish setup you may recall from science class. Basically, you swab samples on them, then wait.
And usually in 24 hours, if there's bacteria in there, the bacteria will grow.
But doctors typically have just minutes to meet with each patient. So 24 hours is a long time. And this system is partly automated.
Our Kiestra system is an automated line where the instrument can actually inoculate a number of the specimens for us, and then the plates that are inoculated pass through the line and go into our smart incubators over here. The instrument will actually open the lid of these culture plates, take a picture of it, and so that the technologist, instead of looking at plates, look at the screens and identify the bacteria.
Among doctors, there's a small obsession that someday we'll have a really fast test, like the tricorder used in Star Trek. We're not there yet. So the federal government started a competition with a $200 million prize for the best solution to the drug resistance problem. And the doctor we met earlier in the ER, Dr. Salik, is among the semifinalists.
Currently, we're standing in our lab space, and this is where we do a lot of our research trying to understand the differences between patients who have different types of infections and different types of disease states.
Symptoms of viral and bacterial infections can look a lot alike, but what if a much closer look could tell them apart?
So our question was, can we differentiate patients who are ill, who have a bacterial infection or a viral infection, or maybe no infection at all?
Volunteers give samples for genetic analysis, which are stored in minus 80-degree freezers. And researchers scour these samples for patterns.
The ways in which all of the different genes in a person's sample, in their blood, are being upregulated or downregulated. Some are turned on, some are turned off, and we're looking at those patterns. And we look for patterns specifically that are in common among patients who have a bacterial infection, and we call those patterns signatures. And that's really what they are. It's a telltale signature that the patient is responding to a bacterial infection or a viral infection or something else.
With the help of machine learning, they found two distinct signatures, one for bacteria, one for viruses. They're also working on new diagnostic methods. A prototype gets results in less than an hour.
We could just take a blood specimen directly from a patient, load it on, takes a couple of minutes of preparation time. You load it into the machine, you close the lid, you push go, and about 45 minutes to an hour later, it gives you your result. So that is substantially easier, substantially faster, and that's what we're currently working on. And so we have the equipment and the setup here in the lab to be able to do that as well.
It tells doctors when the infection is a virus so they can avoid giving an antibiotic. Dr. Chris Woods is one of the researchers. He also heads the Division of Infectious Diseases at the VA Medical Center.
We've done similar work here where we can show that the proteins expressed in the nose actually suggest the presence of a viral infection as opposed to a bacterial infection or something else. And we can get to the point of having a tissue sample that turns colors blue if you have a virus, yellow if you have a seasonal allergy, etc.
In other words, a diagnostic handkerchief.
It really would be revolutionary, and we see moving in that direction.
Better diagnostic tests are important, but so are new ways to defend against bacteria. And our next best defense may not be a drug as we know it. Researchers are looking at how bacteria naturally crowded in our bodies may be useful in fighting superbugs.
Sure, the microbiome is a term used to describe all of these living things that you can't see with your naked eye.
That's Gautam Dantas, a microbiologist at Washington University in St. Louis.
Virtually any way that we investigate under a microscope by zooming in, for instance, right, the way you would zoom in on your phone. But now imagine zooming in on your phone like 10,000 times. Then you'll start seeing these living things, which are small, but they do these incredible things.
Most of the bacteria aren't harming us, but a tiny number of bugs do cause problems.
We call them pathogens. Sometimes we use the word germs. Even though they're the minority of most microbes that we know, when they come into the body, obviously they're going to do bad things. And as it turns out, these good guys, the microbiome in general, a big part of what they do is they keep those bad guys out. They just basically occupy the space that the bad guys may want to use. And so they just will not share that space. And so then the bad guys can't take hold. But they also do it actively. So they produce some particular molecules, for instance, that actively go and attack some of the bad bugs.
Good guys, bad guys. It sounds an awful lot like an action movie.
But like any really, really good action movie, you know, most characters are not one-dimensional. They're not kind of black and white, right? They're not, you know, the bad guys might have a backstory that tells you why they might be bad. And maybe they were good once upon a time. And, you know, and the good guys, they're not always good, right? They might have some vulnerabilities. You know, when Iron Man and Captain America battle it out, you know, those are two good guys fighting. And, you know, the microbiome actually can follow some of those analogies, right? You can have good bugs gone bad because, you know, they over time develop a way to start harming us, even though initially they were doing good things in us.
And it's this process of evolution that's landed us here in the first place. But consider how a bacteria can start off harmless and then join the dark side. It can happen when antibiotics kill off their competition.
And so sometimes bacteria that are perfectly harmless when they're down at very low levels, when they suddenly bloom up because of something else that happens, maybe their competitors die down, once they get above their sort of normal levels, then they can become bad guys.
But what if those good bacteria did more than muscle out the bad bugs? What if they went on the attack against superbugs? That work is underway in upstate New York, where researchers at Cornell are working to reprogram bacteria to fight on our behalf.
My name is Guillaume Lambert. Even now, most commonly used antibiotics, we don't really know how it kills the cell. So it's still a mystery even up to now. I mean, almost a century after we first discovered the first antibiotics.
He works on a tiny scale, using minuscule tubes 1/1,000,000th of a meter in size, where he traps individual cells.
So if you want to look at the bacteria, it has no color. It's hard to visually see it. For the case of my approach, I use green fluorescent proteins from jellyfish to be able to visualize them.
It helps him look for cells that survive drug treatment.
You can isolate the cells that survived and then sequence them and see what was special about them. So, for example, one strategy that the cells can use to survive antibiotics is to enter a state called persistence. So in this state, cells stop dividing. They're not growing, but they're not dying either. They kind of enter this dormant state. So that's why when you go to the doctor and they ask you to take all of your antibiotics, it's because you can have these persister cells present.
He's trying to identify how cells do this using gene editing technology called CRISPR. He also uses CRISPR to study the way cells fight amongst themselves for scarce resources. He hopes to recreate it and then manipulate it.
So, for example, you can recruit some of the cells that you already have in your gut system, for example, and have them identify pathogens or invaders and have them treat the invaders in your gut without requiring external input.
But there's a catch.
You don't want the bacteria to turn against your own cells. So this kind of warfare happens all the time, either in soil or in your gut system or in most environments. To achieve that, we need to be able to program it to be a bit better than the invader.
At MIT, researchers are taking a different approach to fighting superbugs.
So my name is Timothy Liu. I'm an associate professor at MIT, and my field is in the area of synthetic biology, where we are re-engineering the genetic code that underpins life to address a wide range of biomedical applications.
In his lab, he successfully killed drug-resistant bacteria with special viruses, confusingly called bacteriophage, or phage for short.
I mean, phages are basically the natural predators for bacteria. So these viruses naturally infect bacteria. We're exposed to them all the time. They're in our bodies. They're in the water. These viruses are not known to infect human cells. They basically are very specific for bacteria. In our hands, what we've decided to do is actually to try to engineer phages that don't freely replicate on their own. So we sort of disable the phages so they act as a one-time delivery vector. But once you put them into the environment or put them into people, they basically just infect the bacteria and then they do their thing, but they don't sort of continuously propagate themselves.
Liu is also using CRISPR. The phages deliver it to the superbug and the CRISPR attacks.
CRISPR is a very, sort of at a high level, the way it works, it's basically a molecular scissor. But in bacterial systems, the way we use it is we try to direct that molecular scissor against genetic sequences that are quote unquote bad, ones that encode antibiotic resistance, for example. And then when the scissor cuts that DNA, that specific sequence, it basically makes the bacteria really unhappy and it causes the bacteria to die. And so what we're using the CRISPR or the scissor to do is to cut the bad bacteria in the location of the bad genes while sparing other bacteria that don't carry those specific genes.
There are some potential pitfalls. Bacteria under attack could release a deadly amount of toxins as they die. They can also learn to evade the attackers, just like they adapt to withstand antibiotics.
Bacteria are really good at developing resistance. And I think at the end of the day, given enough time, they're going to win. But that being said, we, I think, have enough technological power to stay ahead of them these days.
And Lou calls himself an optimist. The Wall Street Journal's Melanie Evans.
If you look around, there are some reasons for optimism. There are, in the market today, some rapid diagnostic tests. For example, there is a rapid test for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, which is generally referred to as MRSA. And MRSA kills about 11,000 people in the United States every year. Pretty much everybody I talk to agrees that if we're going to succeed, we're going to have to use the antibiotics we've got more judiciously, but we're also going to have to seriously innovate. And we're going to have to do it quickly because we are running out of time.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was reported by The Wall Street Journal's Melanie Evans. The show is produced by Laura Sim and Martha C. Daniel. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Gene Whalen, Stephanie Ilgenfritz, Robert Lee Hotz, Amy Doxer-Marcus, Larry Root, Parminder Barra, Dipti Kapadia, Christopher Moran, Jennifer Hicks, and Mike Miller. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong from the Newsroom in New York.